Okay, good morning, everybody. It's Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, what, the 25th? Yeah, I believe it's the 25th. Okay, so this Thursday, 27th, Thanksgiving, that's a holiday, so you don't have to come to class. And we're going to finish up chapter 14 today, and not start respiratory physiology, but we're going to finish up of cardiac output, blood flow, and blood pressure, chapter 14. And then when is your next exam? Well, it's not on a Tuesday, it's on a Thursday. So it is two and a half weeks away is the next exam. And I've updated a couple more chapters in Blackboard, so you know the right online study questions. I think I did chapter 14, chapter 16, and even 17 are updated. I got two more chapters to do. I don't want to go look and take time to do that, but only the last two chapters I haven't updated, but I'll do that real soon. Okay, do we have any news from SI? SI News? Okay, thank you. All right, so we were in chapter 14, and we were talking about stroke volume. And there are two ways to think about the heart in terms of contraction. One more light. There, how's that? And that is, the heart can be regulated by adjusting the heart rate, and the heart can be regulated by adjusting the force of contraction, two different ways. And what do we call it when we adjust the rate of something on the heart, the rate of the heart? Chronotropy. Yeah, chronotropy is adjusting the rate. And what do we call it when we when something adjusts the force of contraction? That would be inotropy, right? So there are agents that can increase the rate. There are agents that can increase the force of contraction. So some are chronotropic effects, some are inotropic effects, and we're going to be using that kind of terminology. All right, so what regulates stroke volume? Stroke volume is just the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats. So it's a volume. You could measure it in milliliters. And stroke volume, right, is directly related to the preload on the heart. And the preload is just the amount of blood that flows into the ventricle during diastole. So preload is what's happening to the heart. The heart is expanding, the ventricles are getting bigger, they're getting stretched, they're filling up with blood, and that's what we call preload on the heart. All right, just the amount of blood inside that ventricle. Right, and that's what we define to be end-diastolic volume. That's the big volume. Okay, what's another volume of the ventricle, the smallest volume called? End-systolic volume, yeah. End-systolic volume. And if you want to find the stroke volume, then you just subtract those two numbers, right? And then you can determine the preload on the heart. And the strength of contraction varies directly with end-diastolic volume. All right, I think you're going to be familiar with that, but it's going to take a couple slides for you to get a good feel for what's happening there. But the strength of contraction you could think of as maybe stroke volume varies directly with end-diastolic volume. Okay? It also is determined by the resistance of blood vessels that it's trying to pump blood into. And that's what we call afterload. So if we group together all of the resistance that all of the blood vessels produce, we call that total peripheral resistance. All right, and so that's going to impede ejection of blood from the ventricle. So if there is no resistance and the ventricle contracts, all right, then it's very easy for the heart to pump that blood out. But as the resistance increases, then the heart has to work harder and harder and harder to pump blood out of the ventricle. Right? And so that's what we call the afterload. Then we talked about last time ejection fraction, and you should think of this as like being a hematocrit. So it's just the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats compared to how much blood was in the ventricle before contraction started. So it's very much like hematocrit, so it's a percent. That's a useful clinical diagnostic tool. Normally it's 60%. So if you know somebody has a leaky valve, for instance, and you're wondering if that is having a bad effect on the heart, you measure the ejection fraction and it turns out to be 60%. Would you want to schedule that patient to have a valve repair?
No.
That's great. You said that right away. Because that surgery is really dangerous and it's not having any effect on the heart because the ejection fraction is completely normal. All right, so that's an important way that we can understand how the heart is functioning. All right, then that takes us to the Frank-Starling law. It kind of relates to preload and afterload a little bit. Here we have a plot of stroke volume versus the end diastolic volume with the heart. So stroke volume you could think of as the strength of contraction or contractility of the heart. And as the heart fills up, what happens to the strength of the heart? Can you tell just by looking at this? If end diastolic volume is here, right, and then end diastolic volume is increased, what happens to stroke volume? It's increased as well, right? And if we increase end diastolic volume, what happens to stroke volume? It increases even once again, right? So this is why we say that the stroke volume is directly related to the end diastolic volume. The heart gets stronger as it starts to stretch out. Right, so as end diastolic volume increases, the myocardium is more stretched, right? That causes a greater contraction and a greater stroke volume. We call this the Frank-Starling law of the heart. So why is this happening? Okay, well, let's look at this thing right here, A. What does that remind you of, where I'm circling? What does that look at? Okay, I see myosin right here. And I see some thin filaments, which are actin. Actin is connected to these Z-discs. So what do we call this thing between Z-discs? That is a structural and functional unit of contraction. That's what we call a sarcomere. Right. All right, so the whole job of a sarcomere is to shorten and contract, produce tension. So if we look at condition A, can this sarcomere shorten any more than it is already? It can't, because the myosin is taking up almost all the area between both Z-discs. So even though there is really good overlap between actin and myosin, which is necessary, right, for muscle contraction, because these filaments have to slide over each other, they can't slide over each other because myosin has no place to go. It just bumps into the Z-disc. So if we're going, let's take a measure of a contraction of this particular muscle. So we stimulate it to contract. Here we have a plot of tension versus time, so it's just a muscle twitch, right? And so that sarcomere can produce a little bit of tension. But let's change something. Let's stretch out the heart a little bit. How does the heart get stretched out? It's when it fills with blood, right? Okay, and as we, and can you see that in condition B right here, the sarcomere is stretched out a little bit? Yeah, compared to condition A. So now you have nice overlap between actin and myosin. So there can be filaments that slide, and now the sarcomere can shorten just a little bit. But it can shorten, and because it can shorten, it can produce more tension. Right, so as, can you see what's happening here? As the heart fills up with blood, what happens to the strength of the heart? It increases. Let's stretch the heart out a little bit more by increasing end diastolic volume. The sarcomere gets stretched out, and now there is a very large I-band, right? So these filaments can slide over each other. There's still really good overlap between actin and myosin for cross-bridge formation, right? So I would expect that this sarcomere right here is going to contract even more strongly than condition A or B, and if we look at the graph, indeed it is. Right, and if we stretch the sarcomere out a little bit more, okay, in this last condition D, we see that it produces a tremendous amount of tension as the sarcomere stretches out, or you could think of that as being end diastolic volume. So as the heart fills up, it gets stronger. That's a really good thing. All right, but let's keep stretching. It's not on this graph, but let's keep stretching the sarcomere. And you know what? I probably just want to draw it on the board. Let's have another condition where we stretch it out some more. So what is that going to look like? So we have a Z, and we have a Z, and here are some myosin. All right, and then what am I drawing in here? Yeah. Okay, so these are big, thick. All right, big, thick, and here is actin. Now, when we stimulate this sarcomere to contract, what's going to happen? Will it shorten? No, because there's no overlap between the actin and myosin. So if the heart stretches too much, if end-diastolic volume is too great, right, then the heart gets weaker when that happens. So here is really what the Frank-Starling law of the heart looks like. All right, so let's put stroke volume here. Stroke volume, which is like contractility of the heart versus end-diastolic volume. That's EDV. All right, so the heart is being stretched out at each of these points. Right, and it increases in this direction. So what did we say about stroke volume with regards to end-diastolic volume? Is it directly related, or is there no relationship, or whatever? What would you say? Directly related. We increase one, the other increases, right? That's what directly related means. And on a graph, directly related looks like that. It's going to be a rising line. Okay. And so the heart gets stronger. That's what we see on that graph right there. And then, right, what happens when we get to this condition here? Right, it can't contract at all. So when the heart is overstretched, right, then the stroke volume decreases, the strength of contraction decreases. So let's fill in some points between this condition, which is an optimal stretch of the muscle, okay, and stretch it out just a little bit more, and finally we get to this thing right here, and this is what the Frank-Starling curve really looks like. So there's an optimal operating area, and I think it's really good for you to appreciate that, okay, because where are you going to be, say you get into a car accident and you start to hemorrhage and you start to lose a lot of blood? Where are you going to be operating on this Frank-Starling curve? What happens to end-diastolic volume? If blood isn't returning to the heart, okay, then end-diastolic volume is going to go down. And what happens to force of contraction when end-diastolic volume goes down? Right, it wanders down in this direction, just like that. Right, so when you're in that terrible accident, right when you want to have a nice strong heart, what's happening to it? It's getting weaker and weaker, and then we say you go into cardiovascular shock because the heart loses strength. All right, well, on the way to the hospital, something can happen to you. Paramedics really can't treat you with drugs or things like that very often, but they can establish, right, access to a vein. They can give you fluids. What would happen if we were to give fluids to somebody in their vein? What would happen to end-diastolic volume? It would increase. There'd be more fluid returning to the heart, right? Then your heart gets stronger and stronger. Even though you hemorrhage, then your heart is going to go back to its normal strength right over here. So in this condition, you'd want to give fluids, right? If the condition was hemorrhage, you lose too much end-diastolic volume, you'd want to give fluids right away to get the strength of the heart back. And that's really good. That can be done on the way to the hospital. So that fluid going into the cardiovascular system is like a miracle drug, right? It just brings back the strength of the heart kind of magically. But you see why? Because of overlap between actin and myosin and the length of this I band right here. All right, what about this? So this is what we call the ascending limb. Ascending limb. And here is the descending limb. Now, why is this important? Well, what is happening to end-diastolic volume when we get down over here? Is it increasing or decreasing? Okay, here's zero. Here's really big. So the end-diastolic volume is continuing to increase. So now the heart is larger than it was, than normal. And then the heart even gets larger than normal. So what's happening here is that As the end-diastolic volume goes up, we demand more on the heart. The preload on the heart increases, and the heart begins to fail because your body is asking it to work too hard. And as it starts to fail, right, the ventricles fill up with more blood. They get very flaccid, right? And when they fill up with more blood, eventually they fill up with a lot of blood. And what does that condition get you to? Something that looks like this. Force of contraction decreases. And in this condition, okay, what would we want to do to somebody that's in heart failure because their end-diastolic volume is too great? Right, so they're in heart failure. Here's a nice miracle drug. You could give them a diuretic. Okay, so in this condition, what does a diuretic do? Just makes you pee, right? You lose volume from your body. You lose blood volume as a result of that. And as you lose volume because you've given a diuretic, what happens to end-diastolic volume? It goes back. What happens to strength of contraction of the heart? It increases, right? You can get it back almost to normal. So just by giving a diuretic because of that Frank Starling law of the heart, it can act like a miracle drug just by losing some fluids. All right, so use that Frank Starling law to know about different ways we would want to treat patients. Okay. Frank Starling law. I wanted to say one last thing. It will come back to me, maybe. Okay. Oh, yes. Okay, Frank Starling law of the heart, right, is just due to these sarcomeres. Right, the position of these sarcomeres before contraction starts, and so where do you find these sarcomeres? Where are these sarcomeres located? What organ are they in? Which one are we talking about? Okay, muscle, but in particular, what kind of muscle? Cardiac muscle, right? Because we're talking about the heart. Right, skeletal muscle acts pretty much the same way. We looked at that length-tension relationship in skeletal muscle. Right, but here we're talking about the heart. So where is this regulation taking place? Where is the adjustment of force of contraction taking place? It's taking place right inside the heart. Right, it's right inside the heart. So the heart has this ability to do it all by itself. It doesn't need hormones, doesn't need any innervation, doesn't need a nerve supply. The heart does it all by itself, and when something regulates itself, we call that intrinsic control, right? Intrinsic control. So Frank Starling law of the heart shows us that the heart can regulate itself intrinsically. Okay. But there are other ways the heart can be regulated. And you're familiar with these because we even look at some of this stuff in that very first lab. Well, here we have a graph that's very similar. We have relative tension versus the length of a muscle. And you could think of this as being like end-diastolic volume increasing. And you're on the ascending limb of the Frank Starling curve. And so the normal heart is right here, right? And notice that, let's just pick a point. At 80% of resting muscle length is producing a tension of about 10, all right? But under sympathetic stimulus, and that could be due to epinephrine or maybe due to the sympathetic nervous system, even at this end-diastolic volume of 80, what happens to the force of contraction? It goes all the way up over here, right? So instead of being about 10, okay, now it's about 30. So even if the preload on the heart isn't changed, the heart will beat more with more vigor, the contractility will increase under sympathetic stimulation. All right, so this is not adjusting the heart rate, this is just adjusting the force of contraction. So how would you talk about this agent if it's adjusting the force of contraction? Okay, yeah, we went over it right at the beginning of class. There are two ways. You can adjust the rate or force of contraction. This one is adjusting the force of contraction. So, right, so the sympathetic stimulus is a inotropic agent, and because it increases the strength of contraction, we call it a positive inotropic agent, or it produces that positive inotropic effect, and that is just due to increased calcium in the sarcomeres, right? And what's the importance of calcium in cardiac and skeletal muscle? It allows the filaments to slide over each other, right? Calcium binds to troponin. Troponin gets tropomyosin out of the way. Then cross bridges can cycle. All right, so with sympathetic stimulation, there are increases of intracellular calcium. And so the force of contraction increases. Where should calcium normally be low? In an unstimulated, in a muscle at rest. And pretty much any cell at rest. Where's calcium high? Inside or outside? It's high outside. That's right. So if we increase calcium inside, that is an important step in excitation-contraction coupling, which is what you're familiar with. All right, here is an extra credit drawing that you'll do in lab. So you guys that have lab today will draw this out, and those of you that have it on Tuesday will draw it out on Tuesday after Thanksgiving. So I sent an email out. Who did not get the email regarding the extra credit assignment? Anybody not get it? Then we'll have to make sure that we make that up to you. Okay, everybody's got it. So here is an important equation, right? It says cardiac output is equal to the rate that the heart beats, or cardiac rate, or you could put HR, right, for heart rate, times the stroke volume. And that's just the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats, right? So what the heck is cardiac output? It's a flow. It's the amount of blood flowing out of the heart, right? Because we know how much volume is pumped every time the heart beats, and we know how many times the heart beats in a second or a minute, okay? Then we can calculate what the cardiac output is. And cardiac output is something that's really important for controlling blood pressure. All right, so what adjusts these things? Or how would we talk about the heart rate versus cardiac output? How would you talk about these two parameters right here? How are they related? They're directly related, right? If you increase the rate of the heart, what happens to cardiac output? It increases. That's pretty intuitive to me. All right, what about you guys? Is that hard to understand? If you increase heart rate, the cardiac output or the amount of blood flowing out of the heart increases. That's not too hard to understand. All right. And what about stroke volume? How's that related to cardiac output? It is directly related as well. So if every time the heart beats, it pumps more blood, right, then certainly it's intuitive that the amount of blood that the heart pumps out every minute is greater. Right, so both heart rate and stroke volume are directly related to cardiac output. If you increase either of these, cardiac output increases. Well, how do these things change? Okay, so what would affect heart rate? What kind of agent would affect heart rate? That would be a rate is a chronotropic agent. Okay, and what would affect stroke volume or the force of contraction? That would be an inotropic agent, right? All right, so here we have the parasympathetic nervous system. Remember, parasympathetic nerves don't go to the ventricle. They only go to the atrium, in particular the SA node and some of the conduction pathways like the AV node. And that decreases the rate of rhythmicity of these centers, so the parasympathetic nerves do what to heart rate? It slows the heart rate down. Right, so you know vagus nerve goes there, number 10, and the parasympathetic nervous system has a counterpart that is antagonistic to it, and what is that? That's the sympathetic nervous system. So here we have both parasympathetic and sympathetic. What's the relationship between these? They're antagonistic to each other, right? But let's forget about parasympathetic. So if we increase sympathetic stimulation to that SA node, what's going to happen to heart rate? It's going to increase. And that's what you see with these arrows. If it's a filled-in arrow, if it's just a solid arrow, that means it's a positive thing, right? It adds to. If it's a dashed line, it's going to decrease or subtract from whatever parameter we're looking at, right? So we can tell that the heart rate slows down because here's that dotted line, right? The heart rate speeds up because here is a solid line. All right, so that's heart rate. We have these two nervous systems that go there. What about stroke volume? Right, because we're really interested in cardiac output. Does the sympathetic nervous system go to the ventricles to affect how the ventricles contract? Ah, I see it right here in that previous graph. And what kind of agent is epinephrine? Yeah, it's an inotropic agent, and you can see a solid line. So what's going to happen to contraction strength? Increase or decrease? It's going to increase, right, because it's directly related. And as the strength of contraction increases, because I see a nice solid line right here, what happens to stroke volume? It increases as well. Okay, so parasympathetic, this is kind of strange, only goes to the atrium, but the sympathetic nerves go both to the atrium and the ventricles. So the parasympathetic nervous system can have no direct effect on stroke volume because there are no parasympathetic nerves that go there. So what can help regulate stroke volume? Well, because of that Frank-Starling law, right, as end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to stroke volume? That's this thing right here. Say you're up over here. If end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to force of contraction? It increases, right? It's directly related, so these are nice solid lines here. And what was another way that we thought about end-diastolic volume? As the heart stretches right before contraction, you have a certain volume of blood inside the ventricle. That's the job of the heart to pump that blood out. Okay, what do we call that? That's what we call the preload on the heart, right? So end-diastolic volume preload. So make sure you write that down over here. Okay, so that just says that if you increase stretch, that increases the strength of contraction, right? So stroke volume is going to increase. So all of these effects right here, stretch, end-diastolic volume, okay, are what kind of effects are they eliciting? A chronotropic effect or an inotropic effect? Inotropic effect, and because it's a solid line, you know it is a positive inotropic effect on the ventricles in particular. Okay. Mean arterial pressure is just the amount of pressure that's trying to force blood back into the heart. Right, so all of these things are trying to push blood out, but mean arterial pressure, because the pressure in your arteries doesn't ever go to zero. Is that right? What is the pressure in your arteries? Everybody knows what it is. I'll give you a hint. Normal blood pressure. What's normal blood pressure? 120 over 80, right? It's not 120 over zero. It only goes down to 80. Right, so there's always pressure inside the arteries that's trying to force blood back into the heart. Well, the heart has to overcome that pressure, right, by the pressure that's trying to force blood back in the heart by contracting even stronger. So this is what we call the afterload on the heart. The heart has to overcome mean arterial pressure. This is afterload. So preload is end-diastolic volume. Afterload is mean arterial pressure. All right, so I think it's pretty important that you just memorize this equation. Cardiac output is equal to heart rate times stroke volume. The other thing you should be familiar with is that cardiac output is directly related to each of these things right here. Okay, let's think about venous return. What the heck is venous return? Somebody tell me, what is venous return? And why do we even want to talk about it? Well, let's figure out what venous return is first. Yeah, it's just the amount of blood that's returning to the heart. And what kind of vessel takes blood back to the heart? A vein, right, by definition. So venous return is just the amount of blood that is going back to the heart. Okay. So, and venous return controls end-diastolic volume, right? As more blood returns to the heart, what happens to the heart? It fills up with more blood, right? So the end-diastolic volume goes up. And we just looked, because of Frank-Starling law, if end-diastolic volume goes up, what happens to stroke volume? Can we go back one? If the end-diastolic volume goes up, stroke volume goes up, right? Cardiac output goes up, because they're all directly related to each other. All right, so venous return or end-diastolic volume controls stroke volume and cardiac output, right? And that can be adjusted by working on some of these veins, and we're going to look at what happens in just a second. Okay, so what controls that end diastolic volume? Well, blood volume and venous pressure. Right, so if there is pressure in veins, that's going to force more blood into the heart. That's going to have the ventricles fill up a little bit more. Vasoconstriction of veins due to sympathetic stimulation, right? That's going to force more blood into the heart. And right, there are other ways that blood is moved to the heart. What are two other pumps that we looked at? Okay, like any time a skeletal muscle contracts, that puts pressure on veins in that area, and that blood will want to go from that high pressure region to low. But which way does it always flow in a normal blood, in a normal vein? When you contract a muscle, where does blood always go when you contract that muscle? Does it ever go back down to the periphery, back to your hand or to your heart? It moves back to the heart, and you know a nice anatomic reason for that, and that is veins have valves. It can only go one direction. It can't go backwards, right? So it's going to help return blood to the heart. And as more blood returns to the heart, how does the heart react? It gets stronger, right, because of that Frank-Starling law. All right, there's another way that blood is returned to the heart from a vein, and this is what we call the respiratory pump. As we breathe in, pressure in our chest decreases, air flows into our lung, but not only air, what else flows into our thoracic cavity? Another fluid is blood that's inside your body, right? So blood. So your lungs are kind of acting like a vacuum cleaner. That vacuum cleaner is also sucking blood up back to the heart. That helps venous return. All right, so we're interested in venous return because it can modify end diastolic volume. And how is end diastolic volume related to strength of the heart or force of contraction or stroke volume? Right, as end diastolic volume increases, the heart gets stronger, right? So that's why we want to talk about that. Well, how can end diastolic volume increase? Well, by increasing venous return. And how are some ways of doing that? When you're breathing, that puts a negative pressure in the thorax, and that helps vacuum clean, right? It just sucks blood up into your thoracic cavity. That increases venous return. All right, so what is one way that you can increase the force of contraction of your heart? Just by breathing, it says right here. All right, that's kind of interesting. All right, here we have blood volume. One way to think about blood volume is if you have, I think I mentioned this before, if you have your car tire and it's kind of flat, it's deflated, which means that you need more pressure in the tire. So what do? Do you take air out or do you put more air in? You got to put more air in, right? So that's going to increase that pressure. So blood volume is going to increase venous return because that's going to increase that pressure. How can we increase blood volume? Well, by adjusting urine volume. And how should that be adjusted? What kind of arrow is that, solid or dotted line? That's a dotted line right here, so that means that as we lose fluid from our body, right, by producing urine, our blood volume goes down. And if blood volume goes down, what happens to venous return? It goes down, and what happens to the strength of the heart? It goes down as well because end diastolic volume, right, is changed. Another way that you can lose fluids or you can lose blood volume is if somebody has edema, if there's swelling in some part of the body, right? So there is fluid that is moving from blood vessels into tissue spaces in between cells. That fluid now is trapped between cells and is not in a vein. So if it's not in a vein, can it go back to the heart? It can't, right? So when somebody has edema or when tissue fluid volume increases, blood volume, what is this arrow right here, solid or dotted? Dotted line, that means blood volume goes down because this volume now is stuck between cells inside your body. What happens to venous return? It goes down, right? The strength of the heart is decreasing when that happens. Okay, so edema can adjust the force of contraction. All right. Venous pressure. All right. As venous pressure increases, what happens to venous return? What is this arrow right here? Solid or dotted? It's solid. So when venous pressure increases, how does that affect venous return? It increases. What happens to end-diastolic volume then? It stretches the heart a little bit more, so the heart gets stronger. Contractility of the heart increases. All right. So how can venous return be adjusted? Well, by the skeletal muscle pump, right? I think I mentioned that before. When that skeletal muscle contracts, it pressurizes the blood in veins in that area, and that's going to squirt blood only back to the heart because veins have valves, right? That's going to increase venous return, and you're going to see an increase in contractility of the heart. Sympathetic nervous stimulation does go to blood vessels, in particular veins, and it causes veins to constrict, right? So veins are going to constrict, their volume is going to decrease, but the total amount of volume of blood in your body doesn't change just because a vein constricts, right? So where does that blood go, right? It goes back to the heart, right? So when veins constrict, there's more blood going back to the heart, and of course that increases end-diastolic volume, stroke volume, and cardiac output. Okay, so this is a pretty good diagram, but I'm not going to have you draw that out. If we look at the amount of blood that's in veins, where does it come from? Well, 10 to 12% is in lungs, in veins in the lungs. 8 to 10% is in the heart, right? Systemic arteries, about 10 to 12%. Capillaries have about 5%. But where is most of the blood in your body? It's in veins, right? Large veins, small veins if we add them together. But the total amount of blood in the systemic circulation, okay, 70% is in veins. So by adjusting the volume of veins, you can make a big impact on where that blood is going, like to the lungs or to the heart or systemic arteries, okay, by adjusting this. And remember, veins are highly compliant. So what the heck does that mean when we say compliant? They can stretch out, they can get large, or they can get small with very small changes in pressure. Right? So a balloon is a lot more compliant, for instance, than your car tire. Right? A car tire is not very compliant. So these veins, because they are compliant, they have a lot of capacitance. Right? And so by adjusting these veins, right, you have a really significant effect on the heart. So we're going to change topics now. So we talked about some intrinsic controls of the heart, some extrinsic. What are some extrinsic controls on the heart? Sympathetic nervous system, right? Parasympathetic nervous system, because these are things that are not inside the heart, right? They're going to the heart from other places, like for instance the medulla. So we call this, and skeletal muscles are not in the heart, so this is what we call extrinsic regulation. Going the wrong way. Extrinsic regulation. What are some other ways that the heart can be regulated? It is by a number of hormones right here. And how many hormones do we see? There are three. And I think maybe you've heard of most of these. Antidiuretic hormone, sometimes we call that ADH. Right? Where does ADH come from? I hope you didn't forget. Where does ADH come from? The pituitary, and in particular the posterior pituitary. Right? And there's only one other hormone, that's oxytocin. But we're interested in antidiuretic hormone. You could put ADH. ADH also has another name, and it's on a slide that's coming up, but you should probably hear it right now because it's important. It's called vasopressin. Vasopressin is another name for ADH. Vasopressin is a hormone that can constrict blood vessels, in particular veins, right? So it can constrict veins. Another one, aldosterone from the adrenal cortex. We call that a mineralocorticoid. It's going to have effect on sodium and potassium in your body. And then here is atrial natriuretic hormone. So here is a hormone that comes from the atrium, yeah, the heart in particular. And it's going to promote putting something in urine. And what is it going to put in urine? Sodium, All right, natriuretic. So it's going to help your body get rid of a lot of sodium. And when sodium goes in to urine, that's going to draw a lot of blood, not a lot of blood, a lot of fluid with it, just because of osmosis. All right, so when you lose sodium, you lose water from your body. All right, so some of these hormones are antagonists to each other, and some work together. Some are agonists, and I want you to know which ones are antagonistic to each other. And I'm not going to answer that right now. So let's look and see how these things work. All right, so here's ADH, vasopressin from the posterior pituitary. All right, it's released, right, when osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, right, monitor a high salt concentration, right? So as your osmolality increases in your body, that means you're losing fluid, you're losing water. So what would you want to do to combat that? You want to stop losing as much water as possible, and ADH will help that. Okay, so let's look at this flow diagram. So the stimulus is dehydration. Right, when you're dehydrated, the amount of salt in your body remains the same. The amount of solvent is reduced, so the concentration of salts in your body increases. Right, so when you're dehydrated, blood volume goes down, but also the saltiness of the blood increases. Right, and we call that osmolality. Right, as your blood becomes more salty, how else can osmolality of the blood increase if we don't change, anything about our hydration state? Well, by eating salt. Okay. So by eating salt, that increases blood osmolality, and there are receptors for that. What part of the brain do we have receptors for that? In the hypothalamus, right? And the hypothalamus says, hey, we need to do something. So there are these osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, and it can do a couple things. It makes a decision, right? Because the osmolality is a lot higher than the set point. Well, it will give you the sensation of thirst, right? And when you're thirsty, what do you have a tendency to do? Drink. Hopefully it's available to you. And when you're drinking, then the fluid volume inside your body increases. Your blood absorbs that fluid, so blood volume increases. That also reduces the saltiness of your blood, right? Now, how does this respond to the initial stimulus? So the initial stimulus was decreasing blood volume. What is the response? Increasing blood volume. How do they relate to each other? Do they add or subtract? Yeah, they subtract. So what kind of feedback loop is that? You see, that's a nice negative feedback loop because they subtract from each other. And does a negative feedback loop maintain homeostasis? Is that good for you? Yes, right? So here is a nice negative feedback loop. Right, just by drinking, that maintains homeostasis. What else can the hypothalamus do? Well, it can signal, or it can send action potentials to the posterior pituitary. And when those action potentials get to the neuron terminus, right, then they're going to release antidiuretic hormone. And you could consider antidiuretic hormone a neurotransmitter, but it gets picked up by the blood. It doesn't go to another neuron, so you can think of it as a hormone. So it has characteristics of both. You could consider that a neurohormone if you wanted to, right? It's probably better to think of it as a hormone more than a neurotransmitter, but it's coming from a neuron, right? You could call it a neurohormone. That's really good. And where do all hormones, how do they get to their target tissue? Do they travel there by a duct? No, they travel in the blood, right? That's where how a hormone gets around. And so antidiuretic hormone increases, and it goes to the kidney, and it tells the kidney to retain water, to produce less urine, right? So when ADH concentration is high, your body is going to produce very little urine that's highly concentrated in salt. It's going to try to preserve as much water in your body. So that's going to increase blood volume and decrease osmolality. And how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Adds or subtracts? Subtracts. And that's what kind of feedback loop is that then? Negative. And what does that maintain? Homeostasis, right. Okay. So ADH. What's another name for ADH? Vasopressin. Okay. Is there any last comment with this? No. Well, one last thing. Okay, if ADH is present, what does it ultimately result in? Increased blood volume, right? So then more blood is going to return to the heart. What happens to the strength of the heart when ADH is present? Does it increase or decrease? That increases because blood volume increases. All right, so vasopressin is another way that your body can regulate blood pressure and activity on the heart. All right, let's look at another hormone, aldosterone. It's a steroid hormone secreted by the adrenal cortex, right? And it's a mineralocorticoid, so it adjusts sodium and potassium, right, inside your body. So, and it helps maintain blood volume and pressure through the resorption and retention of salt, in particular sodium. So when aldosterone is secreted, the kidney is going to make sure that your body contains a lot of salt, which increases the osmotic drive of water from the kidney or from urine back into the blood. All right, so aldosterone causes what we call the reabsorption. And I think that term you should be aware of from anatomy. Resorption is something moving from filtrate back into the blood. That's resorption. Sometimes a book might call that ultrafiltrate, or filtrate is the same thing. But the volume of urine is going to decrease. Okay, so aldosterone is released by salt deprivation, right? Because aldosterone causes sodium to be resorbed. Low blood volume, because when sodium is resorbed, water travels along with it. Right, so if you have a very salty solution and one that's not so salty, then water is going to flow from the more dilute solution to the concentrated solution, just down its concentration gradient. And when it also is released when there is low blood pressure. Okay, because when you retain salt, you retain water, that helps blood volume, that helps return to the heart, that increases contractility of the heart, and blood pressure is maintained by aldosterone. All right, so let's look at this one right here. Aldosterone is released when there's low blood volume, so that means that it helps increase blood volume. What was antidiuretic hormone? What does it do? It increases blood volume again. Right, so both ADH and aldosterone, right, work together. They are synergists. They both help maintain blood pressure. So let's look a little bit more about this aldosterone hormone and how it works. Well, here is a system, a renin-angiotensin aldosterone system, and this is the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure, long-term regulation. And I guess we would expect that because most of these things here are hormones, right? Hormones have a relatively long period of action. They take longer to have an effect, but they can last for a long period of time. And this system regulates blood pressure in what sense? How does the system regulate blood pressure in the long term? Not from second to second, like when you go from a sitting position to a standing position, but from day to day, week to week, month to month. And what do you know about blood pressure? Does it ever go beyond the normal bounds of 120 over 80? Does it ever increase above that or decrease? Are you familiar with any conditions? If blood pressure is too high, what do we call that? That is hypertension. Yeah, and that's epidemic, right, in the United States, maybe all over the world. And so there is something that's not behaving properly in this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Right, so if we know something about this system, we can help people regulate their blood pressure, and that's a huge problem because high blood pressure is going to force this Frank Starling curve way over here to the left, right, which causes heart failure. Okay. All right, so let's look at this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. It produces something called angiotensin 2 because it comes from a precursor, angiotensin 1, and that stimulates aldosterone secretion. And angiotensin by itself causes vasoconstriction. What effect will that have on blood pressure when you vasoconstrict? Think of that balloon once again. Squeeze down on the balloon. Say it's a water balloon. You got that water balloon, you start squeezing. What happens to pressure inside that balloon? It increases. Right, so vasoconstriction increases blood pressure. Right, and don't squeeze it too much because it will pop right in front of your face. Aldosterone will increase blood pressure, right, because it's going to cause the resorption of sodium back into the body. That's going to draw water with it, right, and it will also give you the sensation of thirst, which will increase blood volume, increase diastolic filling of the heart, and that's going to increase force of contraction. That's going to increase blood pressure. So here is the whole renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. This is probably the most important cardiovascular slide that you're going to be looking at, because what does this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system regulate? What does it regulate? Blood pressure in the long term. All right, so this helps determine if somebody has hypertension or hypotension. Hypotension is really usually not a bad thing. The less pressure you have in your arteries, the less cardiovascular disease people have. So the lower you can get that blood pressure, the better it is. But it shouldn't be so low that when you stand up, you pass out. That's not good, right? Because then your head bounces off the table, then the chair, and then the floor. That's not a good thing. But the lower your blood pressure, that's great. Okay. Well, let's start with the stimulus. Decrease blood pressure, decrease blood flow to the kidneys. When there is decreasing blood flow, less blood goes to the kidneys, and your kidney is able to sense that in an area called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. We talked about that in anatomy. That's right where the distal convoluted tubule passes through the afferent and efferent arterioles. Right? And when there is a decrease in blood pressure, right, that apparatus is going to secrete renin. Right, and notice how it's spelled, just one N right in there. And renin is an enzyme. It's not a hormone. It's an enzyme, so it catalyzes a reaction. And here's the reaction that it catalyzes in the blood. So it's in the blood where this takes place. It will change angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. All right, and what can you tell me about angiotensinogen? I'm not sure we talked about this. Maybe we did. I see a very familiar suffix at the end of this word, ogen. Whenever you see a word with an ogen on it, that means it's an inactive molecule but can be converted into an active form very rapidly. So we ran into this, where did we look at this? Like pro. If you see a pro at the beginning of a word, that means it's inactive. Ogen at the end means pretty much the same thing. All right, so angiotensinogen is inactive. It can become activated by renin from the kidney. Angiotensin has some effects in the body, but they're not major. Right? It's best to convert angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2, and that happens mostly in the lungs with an enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme. We just call that ACE. Has anybody ever heard of an ACE or an ACE inhibitor before? Probably. I'm sure you have. Maybe you're just blocking it at the moment. All right. So angiotensin converting enzyme converts angiotensin 1 to 2. Okay. And then angiotensin 2 has a direct effect on arterioles, causing vasoconstriction. And when that vasoconstriction increases, squeeze down on a balloon once again, what happens to pressure? It increases. All right. That's kind of a good analogy, but in a second you'll see a better way to think about it. Angiotensin 2 also goes to the adrenal cortex, and a nice solid line right here is going to cause the secretion of aldosterone, right? And aldosterone does what? It helps retain salt and water by the kidneys, right? And that increases blood volume. And how does increasing blood volume and increasing blood pressure relate to the initial stimulus? It is, they subtract from each other, so this is a very important negative feedback loop that maintains homeostasis, blood pressure homeostasis in your body. All right, so you can see that there are a number of steps right here. When somebody has hypertension, there's something wrong with this mechanism. So if somebody were to tweak various steps of this mechanism, maybe we would be able to reduce somebody's blood pressure. All right, so let's look and see what that happens. All right, hypertension can be managed with diuretics. What does a diuretic do? Makes you pee, makes you lose blood volume, all right? And what happens here? makes you lose blood volume, that decreases blood pressure, right? That decreases blood. So it's just a diuretic, right? It's probably the first line of management when somebody has hypertension. Your blood pressure is going to decrease. Blood volume decreases, less blood goes back to the heart, so the heart gets weaker because of the Frank-Starling law, right? So, and when your heart gets weaker, your blood pressure goes down. You can take ACE inhibitors, right? Angiotensin-converting enzymes. That's going to work in the lungs. That's going to slow down the conversion of angiotensin 1 into 2. And remember, angiotensin 2 is really the active agent that's working here, right? Angiotensin 1 is just the step to get to angiotensin 2. All right, so we can inhibit this process. All right, so if we inhibit this process, what happens to blood volume? It's going to decrease. Right, what happens to blood pressure? It's going to decrease. Right, so ACE inhibitors are very important. Well, let's work on this leg over here. Right, so angiotensin 2 has to have receptors in the adrenal cortex. Right, and when angiotensin 2 binds to these receptors in the adrenal cortex, what is released? Aldosterone. Okay, and that's going to increase blood pressure as well. Okay, so another class of agents are what we call ARBs. ARBs are angiotensin receptor blockers. Okay, so ARBs block receptors in the adrenal cortex, so the adrenal cortex doesn't secrete so much aldosterone, and when it doesn't secrete aldosterone, what happens to blood volume and blood pressure? If aldosterone goes away, blood volume decreases, blood pressure decreases as well. So that's a pretty good treatment for high blood pressure as well. So you got diuretics, you got ACE inhibitors, ARBs. Okay, something else. Beta blockers. What do you know about, what is this beta referring to? You know something about alpha too? Okay, blockers. It's going to block. It's going to block a receptor. All right. Are you familiar with beta receptors? Where did you learn about beta receptors? In the autonomic nervous system, in particular sympathetic nervous system. And what kind of beta receptors do you have in the heart? What kind of receptors do you have in the lungs? That's a hint. They are beta 2 in the lungs. They are beta 1 in the heart. And if we block those receptors, okay, then we're blocking force of contraction of the heart, right? Because sympathetic stimulation causes increased force of contraction. We block the sympathetic nervous system, the heart is going to lose contractility. So how would you talk about a beta blocker? Is it a chronotropic agent or inotropic agent? Okay. Inotropic, because it's going to cause the heart to beat weaker. And is it a positive or negative inotropic agent? Okay, positive will increase force of contraction. A beta blocker is going to decrease force of contraction. So it's a negative inotropic agent. Right? Probably some of you have heard of beta blockers. Calcium channel blockers. Okay, remember, calcium is necessary for excitation-contraction coupling. If you block the entrance of calcium into the cell, that decreases the force of contraction that sarcomeres can produce. And that's, so the heart gets weaker when we give calcium channel blockers, and so blood pressure will decrease as a result of that. All right, so hypertension is a really important problem. It should be addressed. If you ignore it, you're going to die. So if you have anybody in your family with hypertension, you just have to be really supportive and help them out, right? And maybe they'll go to the doctor and the doctor will prescribe a diuretic and it lowers it a little bit, but not a lot. So then the patient has to go back to the doctor again and maybe they put on ACE inhibitors. That helps a little bit more, but you don't stop taking the diuretics. And maybe your blood pressure still isn't controlled. And then you have to take something like a beta blocker or an ARB. So that takes a long time to figure that out. Somebody with hypertension might actually have to go a year before they figure out the right combination of drugs. And during that time, right, that family member of yours that has hypertension, they feel fine. When you have hypertension, you feel great. And when your blood pressure goes back down to normal, this is a terrible thing. How does somebody feel when your blood pressure goes from high back to normal? You feel terrible. You feel lethargic. You don't feel like doing anything. So That is unfortunate because that produces, what, a very low compliance, right? People don't like to take these things to reduce their blood pressure because it makes them feel bad. But if they don't, what's going to happen? They're going to die because of hypertension, right? All right, so if you go home today and you yell at somebody because they're not taking their pharmaceutical agents to reduce their blood pressure, is that going to help? No, because when you start yelling at them, what happens to their blood pressure? It's probably going to increase, right? So you got to do it just right. You can't hassle them, but you just have to support them some way or another, right? Okay, don't let them miss a visit to the doctor's office, right? Drive them there and just make nothing of it. Just say, oh, I'm going that way. Why don't you hop a ride with me? I'll take you there, okay? All right, so why is this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system important? Because what does it regulate? Blood pressure in the long term. So this is the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure. Okay. All right, the last one, atrial natriuretic hormone. I give some references here if you want to look up some of these pharmaceutical agents. Right, so you're going to run into all of them. Oh, one thing I didn't mention, alpha-2 agonists. These are in the central nervous system, and I don't talk about them because they're pretty complicated. There is a drug called clonidine, and clonidine is a very radical, very powerful drug that will drop somebody's blood pressure almost immediately from a dangerous condition down to normal, and probably nobody really wants to experience that. But if, for instance, you have a blood pressure of 220 over 150, very high blood pressure, what could happen to a blood vessel? Well, it could just rupture, right? And it could rupture at any second. So in those circumstances, you want to reduce that kind of blood pressure, right? Clonidine is an agent that can do that because it works on that kind of receptor, right? An alpha adrenergic receptor. Too bad we don't have time to talk about that. I'm not sure. Maybe after class. I don't know. I can't quite hear what you're saying. So probably after class, we'll talk about that. Okay. Atrial natriuretic hormone, right? When blood volume expands, it causes increased stretch of the heart. When the heart stretches out, it releases AMP. We'll just call that atrial natriuretic peptide. You could call it a hormone because it is a hormone that comes from the heart. So if here is a hormone coming from the heart, what could you tell me about the heart? What kind of gland is it? It's secreting this thing. It's an endocrine gland. I don't know if you've ever thought about the heart as being an endocrine gland before, but it is because what does it secrete? A hormone called atrial natriuretic hormone or peptide. All right, and that does a couple things. It inhibits aldosterone. What's the effect of blood pressure on aldosterone? It increases. Aldosterone increases blood pressure, so what does atrial natriuretic hormone do to blood pressure? Decreases it. So what's the relationship between atrial natriuretic hormone and aldosterone? They're antagonistic to each other. Really nice to have antagonistic control, right? Just like on your car. It promotes salt and water, what, retention or excretion if you want to decrease blood pressure? Excrete. Get rid of water from your body, right? And get rid of salt because water has a tendency to go along with salt. That reduces blood volume, and that reduces contractility of the heart, reduces blood pressure. And it promotes vasodilation. So blood has a tendency then to pool in veins, less goes back to the heart, and diastolic volume goes down, strength of contraction of the heart goes down, blood pressure goes down as well. I don't know of any pharmaceutical agents that work on this particular system. All right, so what we saw, let's look at this figure really fast. Okay, so if we increase blood volume, then you have more venous return. What happens to the ventricle when you have more blood returning to it? It stretches more, right? And the atrium then it can do a couple things, right? It can secrete atrial natriuretic hormone, makes a decision to do that, or it can actually send signals via the vagus nerve to the brain, and we'll look at this in just a second. All right, so let's get back to atrial natriuretic hormone. It goes to the kidney. Right, and it tells the kidney to start excreting sodium and water, right? And that increases urine volume. When you increase urine volume, what happens to blood volume? It decreases. And then what happens to venous return? It decreases. So what is this response compared to the stimulus? Do they Do they subtract or add together? Okay, so here we have increasing blood, increased blood volume. Here we have decreased blood volume. They subtract from each other. So here is a nice, it says right here, nice negative feedback mechanism. What does it maintain? Homeostasis of blood pressure in particular. Okay, also, the vagus nerve is stimulated. That goes to the brain, hypothalamus, which sends signals to the posterior pituitary to slow down or cut back the amount of vasopressin that is released. Right? And remember, ADH or vasopressin goes to the kidney. And, there's a couple of negatives right here. It helps retain water in the body. Right? And so a way of saying that, it decreases water resorption. And what is that resorption? You might have to go back to anatomy and look at that. Resorption is taking water from urine and putting it back into the blood. All right, so when that happens, okay, then blood pressure is going to decrease. It will subtract. Okay, when we decrease antidiuretic hormone, this effect goes away, which means we don't resorb so much water. And that just means that we produce more urine when ADH concentration goes down, right? We produce more urine when you take this antidiuretic away, right? Does that make sense? There's kind of a lot of negatives right there, but I think you can follow that through. All right, so what's the relationship between these three hormones, ADH and aldosterone? These are synergists, okay? And what about between aldosterone and atrial natriuretic hormone? Antagonist, right? And what about atrial natriuretic hormone and antidiuretic hormone? Antagonist as well. So there are more hormones to increase blood pressure than there are to decrease. But I do see some antagonistic control, which is important. All right, so what's the most important long-term mechanism for regulating your heart, not your heart rate, but blood pressure? It is you got to get the steps down, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, right? And it's a hormonal mechanism. Okay. All right, so we're going to change different topics in this chapter. Factors that affect blood flow. All right, so what are some? Vascular resistance determines how much blood flows through a tissue and organ. Right, vasodilation decreases resistance, and resistance and blood flow. How's resistance and blood flow related to each other? Vasodilation decreases resistance and increases blood flow. So they are indirectly related, right? So as resistance increases, blood flow decreases. And I think you have a good appreciation of that. I just say it's inversely related, not directly related. Right? Vasoconstriction does the opposite. Increases resistance that decreases blood flow, right? Which is kind of the same thing as what we said over here. We can look at distribution of blood flow through the body, and most of this pretty much makes sense. What makes sense? Brain gets about 13%. Right? Gastrointestinal tract is busy all the time, gets about a quarter of the blood flow. Skeletal muscles, because we use skeletal muscles all the time, gets about 21%. But here is something. Look, the kidneys. The kidneys are really small. They're about as big as your fist. And they get one-fifth or 20% of the cardiac output from the heart. That's a huge amount compared to their size. All right, what is the largest organ system in your body? What's the largest one? You know what it is. Skin. Yeah, what do we call that? Integumentary system, right? Integument. All right, and if we look at the integumentary system, it only gets 9%, right? So the largest one gets 9%, the kidneys get 20%. So that just tells you what the metabolic activity of those two organs are. Your skin is not very metabolically active, but your kidneys are. Right, because of all those, we'll see all those sodium, potassium, ATP pumps that are being used all the time. All right, so this slide is sort of interesting. So how do we think about blood flow? Well, how do we think about diffusion? Why do molecules diffuse? What's the force that's driving diffusion? Something goes from high concentration to low. The higher the concentration gradient, the faster the rate of diffusion. And if the concentration between these two spaces equalizes, what happens to diffusion then? It stops, right? It stops. When the concentration is the same, it stops. So in terms of blood flow, you could think of pressure as being the concentration of a solute. So as blood pressure increases, what happens to flow? It is directly related, so it increases as well, just like concentration gradient for diffusion. All right, so there has to be a pressure difference. Flow is directly, and I want to use the word related because we're using that a lot in this class, directly related to the pressure difference. So here we have left ventricle pumping blood through, a circulation goes back to the right atrium. What circulation is that? What is that? From the left ventricle back to the right atrium. Nice systemic circulation, right? So left ventricle is really strong, produces really high pressure. And right in this aorta right here, we can measure the pressure normally to be what, 120 over 80, right? Systolic over diastolic. We can figure out what the average is. It's about 90-something. Your textbook says 100, just kind of ballpark. And so this is 100 millimeters of mercury. And if we measure pressure over here by the right atrium in the vena cava, what's the pressure? It's zero. So what's the pressure gradient? It's just one minus the other. Right? So it is 100 minus 0, so the gradient is 100 millimeters of mercury from the left ventricle to the right atrium. So which way is blood going to flow? It's going to flow from a ventricle to the atrium because the flow is directly related to the pressure. Right? And what happens to the flow if we increase pressure? We increase blood flow. Okay. All right, so here is... an important equation probably you have to memorize as well. Where's the light? Oh, lights are over here. Is that it? Okay. I'll just write it right here for now. So blood flow, that's a volume for time, right? We say is equal to the blood pressure, the mean arterial blood pressure. Right, so that's directly related. What did we say was inversely related to blood flow? Is resistance. Okay, so that one you should just memorize and just have a nice intuitive sense. Flow increases if you increase pressure. Flow decreases if you increase resistance because it's inversely related. Okay, can you see the screen okay? Because I think I might want to keep the lights on. So flow is equal to delta P, the difference in pressure divided by resistance. All right, but what about resistance? What is it equal to? I don't know if I can remember. You guys have had lab. You can remember that. What about resistance? What is that equal to? Resistance of a blood vessel. How about if you make a blood vessel longer? Does the resistance increase or decrease if you make a blood vessel longer? Okay, make a blood vessel longer, the resistance increases. It increases. So it's directly related. So where would we want to put length of a blood vessel? Directly related? Right here. I'll use a capital L. Okay. What about if we adjust the viscosity, which is the fluidity of blood? We make it more viscous, which means it looks less like a fluid, more like a solid. Right, so if it becomes more viscous, what would be viscous, more viscous? Like molasses versus water. Molasses is a lot more viscous, right? So where would we put that? Okay, viscosity. As we increase viscosity, right, your blood turns into a sludge, right? So that increases resistance, right? So when viscosity is changed, resistance increases, and how are we going to use that little letter right there? Little Greek letter. Okay, so we increase viscosity, all right, we increase resistance. That's right, it's directly related. All right, what else? What else adjusts the flow through a blood vessel? And this is probably the most important thing. Yes, okay, so here's a cross-section of a blood vessel. Here's the center of it. Okay, here is what? The diameter. A diameter is just a way of measuring what? The radius of that blood vessel. You increase the diameter, you increase the radius. Okay. Resistance decreases when the radius increases. as a blood vessel gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it's easier for blood to flow through it. You did an experiment in lab, or you will this week, right? You'll use different sized glass tubing, and you'll measure flow of water through bits of different tubes of different diameters, and you'll see that the bigger diameter tube, more flow with the same pressure can go through that tube. All right, but here is something interesting. It's just that the radius, right, will decrease resistance. It is the radius times the radius. So if you change the radius, right, and you have to multiply by each other, so that's a big factor, right? So now you have a big factor in the denominator. What happens to resistance? It decreases, right? So is R times R bigger than R? R times R bigger than R? Yes, right? You multiply two numbers together, they're bigger than the first number. So as this number gets big, right, and it gets big in a hurry because they're multiplied by each other, what happens to resistance? Yeah, it decreases rapidly, like this term right here. All right, but that's still not the whole truth. It's radius times radius times radius. It's that number multiplied by itself two times. So what happens to this number here if we change resistance? It gets a lot bigger fast. Right, which does what? Decreases radius in a big way. But that's still not the whole story. And this is the last change, all right? It's resistance times resistance times resistance times resistance. It's the change multiplied by itself four times. That's huge, all right? So if this number gets huge over here, what happens to resistance? Decreases in a huge, big way. Right, so as the diameter of a blood vessel increases, that resistance decreases very rapidly. All right, so what can you change in your body to adjust this resistance? Can you change the length of a blood vessel? Okay, only maybe in one spot that I'm aware of, but we can't change the length of a blood vessel. Okay, so the length of a blood vessel from your heart down to your thumb, you can't really adjust that. It's going to be stuck. It's just whatever distance that is. You can't adjust that. What about viscosity of the blood if you want to adjust resistance? Maybe a little bit, right? But that is just a single term. If it was viscosity times viscosity times viscosity times viscosity four times, then maybe it would have some kind of effect. But generally, the viscosity of blood does not change very much. Sometimes athletes adjust it. Maybe we have time to talk about that. But usually it does not change. Right, so length and viscosity of your blood really has no effect on resistance because it can't change. What about a diameter of a blood vessel or radius of a blood vessel? Yes, can be regulated a lot by intrinsic control, by metabolites, or by the sympathetic nervous system. Right, can cause vasoconstriction. We talked about that. So if you vasoconstrict, then this number is decreasing very rapidly, which means the resistance increases rapidly. So as you vasoconstrict, resistance goes way up. Now, where was resistance in this term over here? Let's put it in here. So we got blood pressure, okay, divided by resistance. And what's resistance? L nu, which is divided by R to the fourth power, right? But if you have something in the denominator, where is that like having it? It's like having it in the numerator, right? But here, you see that this is resistance, right? So let's get rid of that because it's too complicated and put it here. Radius to what power? The fourth power. Okay. So as the radius increases, what happens to blood flow? And this is going to stay constant. So what are we going to do here? We're going to have blood pressure, right, times resistance. And this we're just going to pull this out over here. All right, we're just going to call that a constant because these things don't change. All right, that is going to be equal to blood flow. Blood pressure times resistance. Okay, and that's what we call Poiseuille's law. And I see that on the PowerPoint slides right here. Since viscosity and length don't change, you can dump them in with these constants here, pi and 8, and it's not going to change this equation. So delta P is blood pressure, right, and the wrong R. If not a big R, that is what? A little r to the fourth power right there. Okay, so how does your body regulate blood flow? By adjusting the radius of a blood vessel. Right? And it's a very sensitive adjustment. Small changes in radius make a huge change in blood flow through a blood vessel. That's what we call Poiseuille's law. Okay. And we got to stop. And we'll pick up with this next week. Okay. So, sign-in sheet is going around. So, is this your most enjoyable chapter so far? Is this cool to see all this stuff? All right, well, there's still a couple more cool things to look at that, and we still got to talk about blood pressure. Okay.